Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The banking crisis, as distinct from the problems in the rest of the economy, has always had a political tinge. Remember, the first bailout plan actually failed in the House of Representatives. And now, in Washington, too big to fail has somehow become too big not to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 9th of March. Bipartisanship has not been a strong suit in Washington for quite a while now, so I suppose this most recent development shouldn't really come as a surprise. But as Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner burns the candle at both ends trying to come up with a strategy to prop up faltering American banks, a couple of high-profile Republicans are saying we'd be better off without him. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports now on the growing political split over how best to save the financials.
Yesterday on ABC's This Week, Alabama Senator Richard Shelby, the highest-ranking Republican on the banking committee, said it's time to cut some big banks loose from government support.
Close them down. Get them out of business. If they're dead, they ought to be buried. We bury the small banks, we've got to bury some big ones.
Arizona Senator John McCain joined the shut 'em down chorus. And former Fed official Vincent Reinhardt says more Republicans are beginning to think the multiple bailouts of financial institutions like Citigroup and AIG have broken traditional ideological taboos against government intervention.
It really rankles the American people's sense of fairness. There's a suspicion that we are shoveling funds to people who are connected, who benefited on the upside, and aren't being asked to bear any of the downside.
The FDIC has already closed down 16 smaller banks just this year, but is reluctant to do the same with bigger banks. Policy analyst Tom Gallagher with the ISI Group says the concern is less political and more pragmatic.
You don't just take a big bank into the government for a short period of time. The government took over Continental Illinois in the 1980s and had some form of government ownership for 7 years.
Still, piecemeal rescues of big financial institutions haven't worked so far. And if bailout fatigue continues to spread in Congress, regulators may find themselves without the money they need to keep propping up big banks. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The possibility of banks failing or at least defaulting on their loans is sending ripples through the credit markets again. If you're thinking right about here that this is where the banking crisis started with phrases like LIBOR coming into more common usage, join the club because the cost of lending between banks is rising again. After brief dips back to something close to normal a couple of months ago, LIBOR, that is the London Interbank Offered Rate, has been creeping up. And Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York that the one part of this financial crisis that seemed to be getting a little bit better now appears to be getting worse.
If LIBOR is not part of your daily vocabulary, you may have heard about it last fall when it skyrocketed to more than 4% during the scariest days of the financial crisis. 4% LIBOR translates to frozen credit markets. It's nowhere near that now, just 1.3%. And the upward movement is different.
It seems more of a fundamentally driven than sort of a panic-driven state of flux.
Guy Labat is chief fixed income strategist with Janney Montgomery Scott.
It's not anything acute or the fear of maybe companies en masse falling apart in a very short period of time. It's just the fact that corporations have gotten less creditworthy as a result of economic problems.
Professor Douglas Diamond at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business says the timing of LIBOR's rise tells its own story. It started in January when investors began to worry that they had placed too much hope in a quick economic fix from the Obama administration.
They're either concerned that they're not as good at working out a plan as they thought, or alternatively that when they looked into the banks, they found something a little uglier than they expected to see, and they're having a harder time fixing the worst problem. And nobody knows which one it is.
But Diamond says everyone's watching Washington for a solution, and not just big investors and corporations. Your adjustable rate mortgage may be tied to LIBOR, and the credit markets are often seen as leading the stock market. Trouble there can spread, as we now know all too well. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Finance ministers from around the world will meet in London this coming weekend to talk about the global economy. They do that from time to time, even when there isn't a crisis. But this time, they'll be trying to iron out their differences ahead of a major meeting, also in the British capital next month. Their bosses, that would be the leaders of what's called the Group of 20 Advanced and Developing Nations, are going to try to come up with a global approach to the current crisis. But with less than 4 weeks to go, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports that even the closest allies can't seem to agree.
President Obama will use the London summit to call for a big global increase in government spending, and he'll aim that message squarely at the Europeans, says Nariman Berovesh of IHS Global Insight.
I think the U.S. is somewhat concerned that the fiscal stimulus coming out of Europe is nowhere near enough to counteract this very deep recession.
The U.S. reckons that it's pumping proportionately four times more money into the American economy than the Europeans are pumping into theirs. Analyst Graham Mather says blame Germany. The continent's biggest and richest country has blocked any plans for a massive Europe-wide stimulus package.
Germany is particularly worried about ending up as the guarantor of other European countries, having German taxpayers pay for every bailout.
The Germans and the French blame the crisis on what they call the excesses of Anglo-American capitalism. They'll use the London summit to call for tighter controls. Katinka Barish of the Centre for European Reform.
Now they're calling for regulation of hedge funds and tax havens and other things. But these are all things that are not directly really responsible for the current crisis. It's just a sort of an immediate, popular and easy thing to do.
The Europeans and the Americans agree on one thing. Summit failure could send markets into a tailspin. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There was a huge, huge drug industry deal announced this morning. Merck's going to spend $41 billion to buy Schering Plough and its pipeline of promising new products. Wall Street couldn't have really cared less. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Stephen Beard was just telling us, the financial world is getting ready for its global close-up next month. Heads of state will meet in London to figure out where to go from here. And somewhere in the backs of their minds will be this word, Japan. How Japan dealt with its financial crisis 15 or 20 years ago is the cautionary tale that policymakers are trying desperately to avoid a repeat of. To see how they're doing at it, we've called Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Adam, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start with one of those economists on the one hand, on the other hand questions. You ready?
Yep.
All right. So on the one hand, I've heard it said that we're reacting to our banking problems faster than the Japanese did. But on the other hand, we're being accused of propping up zombie banks, banks that aren't doing so well without government money. Which is it?
It's both. The Japanese took almost 10 years to get around to fixing their bank problems, which is a historic high for slowness. And so the fact that we're faster than the Japanese were until they got it together isn't really much praise. So in terms of history, if the Geithner administration of Treasury gets the banks fixed in the next year, it will still look pretty good by historical standards. But in the meantime, we're seeing a lot of rumors in the market, a lot of instability, and like you said, zombie banks making the wrong kinds of loans.
Are you buying actually that description of American banks as zombie banks that would be dead were it not for government money?
The problem with zombie banks is that they don't stay dead. If they just died, then we'd be okay. The problem with zombie banks is they go out there trying to eat the brains of perfectly good companies and depositors and keep the money for themselves. I don't think that's true of the vast bulk of American banks, but I have no doubt that that's true for some of the least capitalized banks, and there are certainly a few of them out there, including some very famous ones.
Yeah, so is it in your mind a question of when and not if we wind up, let's not use the N word, but let's say taking over some of these big banks?
aptly put, yes. If there were a government takeover of a few of these undercapitalized banks that are behaving in fashions that waste taxpayer money, I think it's both a good thing and it's going to happen in the end anyway. There may not be that dreaded N-word nationalization. There probably will be some value left for the current shareholders of these banks. But in point of fact, you're not going to get to the other end of this mess without some sort of government control. And the good side of that is without the taxpayers then getting any benefits from assets later being sold at a higher value.
Let me get back to where we started, which is that confluence of what the Japanese did and what we're doing. Have we learned the lessons of Japan of 15 years ago?
I think we've learned two of the three lessons from Japan. Lesson one was you don't raise taxes in the middle of the recession. You try to stimulate. The second lesson is you admit that you don't want to leave banks in business when they're undercapitalized for years at a time. And the Obama administration, the president himself, have said they're not going to do that. So that's two good lessons. But the third lesson, which is at some point you really do have to start shutting down in an orderly way some of the undercapitalized banks and maybe taking over some of them. That one we haven't seemed to learn yet. It's possible that the administration is just waiting for the end of these so-called stress tests, but remains to be seen.
Well, if these stress tests, the examination of the banks that the government's doing to see, frankly, how they're doing, if those stress test results don't come back with good marks, I guess, and we do wind up taking over some of these banks, how hard will it be eventually to undo that nationalization, that is to reprivatize these things?
It's a very legitimate question, and there are ways you can make it easier. One of them is you start selling off good parts of these banks that were considered too big to fail just to begin with. So within Citi or Bank of America or any of the other big banks people are worried about, there are plenty of pieces that pretty quickly could be extricated and sold back to the private sector. I just want to reassure people that while this is complicated, it is doable.
Adam Posen is the deputy director at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
The president's automotive task force is in Detroit today. Members are doing fun things like driving in the new electric Chevy Volt. They're touring a Chrysler plant. And somewhere along the way, they're trying to decide whether Chrysler and General Motors ought to get $39 billion in government loans. On the face of it, GM is a car company, but it knows more about loans than you may think. It was pretty much built on borrowing, our borrowing. This seems hard to believe right now, but there actually was a time when consumers frowned on going into debt for life's pleasures. That began to change about 100 or so years ago. And as we continue our coverage of this country's changing relationship with credit, Stephen Smith of American Radio Works takes us back to the beginning.
Back in the 1910s and 20s, factories across the country were pumping out an unprecedented wave of new consumer products.
America, industrial miracle of the century. From all the states flow bounteously the products of forest, mine, and field.
This vintage promotional film celebrates the flood of new durable goods pouring over American consumers, like washing machines, phonographs, radios, and refrigerators. But historian David Farber says there was a problem. Big-ticket items were still too expensive for many middle-class Americans, and there was no such thing as Visa or MasterCard.
There was no consumer credit in the beginnings of the 20th century. There were no credit cards at all. So smart entrepreneurs started to think through the problem. How do you get people to buy things that they can't afford with the money in their pocket?
Cash up front was a particular challenge for middle and working class people who desired that popular new machine called the automobile. An average family would have to save for about 5 years to buy a car. The Merry Oldsmobile, along with the Buick and the Chevrolet and other cars, was made by an innovative young company called General Motors.
General Motors invented the credit system. They created the modern methods of advertising and marketing. General Motors was really at the forefront of creating, in many ways, what we think of as modern consumer capitalism.
Here's how GM helped spawn the American way of debt. In 1919, GM was trying to catch up with the world's number one automaker.
The little old Ford, it rambled right along, the little old Ford rambled right along. Now
Henry Ford's Model T was plain, simple, and relatively cheap. It came in one color, black. To buy one, you paid cash up front. GM cars were more colorful and more stylish and more expensive. David Farber says GM gained on Ford by starting a credit war.
General Motors creates automobile loans. 1919, 1920, they create the General Motors Acceptance Corporation. And that allows people to buy more expensive cars by going into debt.
Historian Lendell Calder says the socially conservative Henry Ford scowled at GMAC's auto loan business.
He had older views about whether it was a good idea for Americans to use debt to finance instruments like cars, and he was against it.
Instead of the new-fashioned installment plan, Ford offered customers the old-fashioned layaway plan.
What Ford asked people to do was to bring every week $5, $10, and deposit it in an account run by their local automobile dealer. And then when they had enough money in the account, only then could they take delivery.
Henry Ford thought he knew the American consumer better than executives at GM. But David Farber says Ford couldn't quite see that attitudes about credit and debt were changing.
You had a country in some ways based on the virtues of avoiding luxury, avoiding debt, of being thrifty. And then suddenly in the 20th century, as manufacturers were able to produce so many goods, they begin to wrestle with the possibility, well, maybe it's good to go into debt. Maybe it's good to have luxury items.
Americans gobbled up the newly available credit. By 1930, most durable goods were bought on the installment plan, including more than two-thirds of all automobiles. Soon, Ford dealers were forced to offer auto loans as well. After World War II, the consumer credit business grew at a dazzling pace. By the end of the 20th century, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation had loaned out more than $1 trillion to car buyers. GMAC expanded into home mortgages and other kinds of credit as well. Historian David Farber says that our modern way of buying and borrowing owes a debt to Detroit.
Bottom line, when I look at what General Motors was able to do from the 1920s, at least through the 1980s, it wasn't chrome on cars. It wasn't necessarily a new six-stroke engine. Is that they were inventive, and credit was one of their greatest inventions.
The question now is whether General Motors can reinvent itself. Both GM and its credit arm, GMAC, are struggling with staggering debts. Both companies are running on federal bailout money. They're essentially borrowing their futures from the American taxpayer. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
That I'm the coolest thing around. Little buddy gonna shut you down. When I turn it on, wind it up, blow it out, GTO.
Coming up, going strong, still in middle age.
She's a very tiny little person. She's not quite 12 inches tall, and you can have her in many hair colors, but blonde seems to be very much preferred.
But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market drifted still lower today, even as financial stocks floated higher for a change. The Dow Industrials dipped 79 points, 1.2%, finished at 6,547. The NASDAQ dropped 25 points, almost 2%, 1268 the number. The S&P 500 lost 6 points and even 1% closed at 676. Bank of America shares bounced nearly 20% today on where the financial giant has raised more than $8 billion, reportedly sold a big block of government-guaranteed debt. Stock in Wells Fargo rebounded almost 16%. Even Citigroup shares picked up a couple of percentage points today, too. IBM was the drag on the Dow, though, slid almost 2.75%. The sell-off, rather, extended across the tech sector, too. Apple lost 2.5%. Hewlett-Packard declined 5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its monthly wholesale trade report for January. President Obama addresses the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce during its annual legislative conference. And a House Subcommittee on Energy and Environment holds a hearing on the future of coal under climate legislation. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Ever since the banking system really went off the rails back last September, when Henry Paulson went to Congress with a 2.5-page proposal that asked for $700 billion, there has been a certain lack of forthrightness about what the money is being spent on, and there still is. Commentator and economist Dean Baker says it's time for the Obama administration to make good on its promise for more transparency.
There's been a lot of talk in Washington about a new era of openness and accountability. But when it comes to the bank bailouts, we're still in the bad old days. We know the basic story. The banks got into trouble with complex financial derivatives that they apparently didn't understand. Their losses left many bankrupt, and the taxpayers must either cough up the money or watch the financial system collapse. Well, the taxpayers still have some options. Specifically, we have the right to demand that money going out the door is actually used to prop up the banking system, and not some well-connected hedge fund's gambling habit. At this point, we just don't know. The secrecy problem is clearest with AIG, the giant insurer that has largely been taken over by the government. The government has already lent AIG $160 billion and will almost certainly lend more in the future. Most of this money will not be repaid. AIG needs taxpayer dollars because it made hundreds of billions of dollars of commitments in the form of credit default swaps, which are a type of bond insurance. AIG has to pay out on these credit default swaps because many of the bonds they insured, which include mortgage-backed securities, are going bad at record rates. The government has no legal obligation to honor AIG's credit default swaps, but ostensibly it is choosing to do so because these swaps are held by financial institutions that could fail if the credit default swaps were not honored. The problem is that the public has no idea if this claim is true because we don't know who holds the swaps and how much they are owed. We don't know if the Fed is only honoring AIG's credit default swaps to ensure the solvency of banks and pension funds, or whether it may be paying off credit default swaps even in cases where hedge funds or other speculators were just making a bet that a bond would go bad. The Fed and Treasury are asking us to trust them with our money. But these are the people who completely missed the buildup of this financial bubble and minimized the problem at every turn. Their track record does not warrant much trust at this point.
Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research. Send us your thoughts about what you hear on the broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. Look for that link that says contact. In case you don't follow toy news closely, here's the top story of the day. America's favorite doll turns 50 years old today. That would be Barbie. And as sometimes happens around that age, she's getting a facelift. Sort of an old face, really. Mattel's releasing a modernized version of the way Barbie looked back in 1959 when she first came out. She has changed a lot since then. White, black, blonde, brunette, princess, rock star. It is a big Barbie world out there.
Huge.
Tina Fleming's the manager at Kipps Toyland here in Los Angeles.
Now Barbie comes with accessories. They do things. This one over here with the horse, and you can comb the horse's hair and put beads in it. And over there is the mermaid. She can go in the bathtub, and the tail moves.
And don't forget the designer versions at $100 a pop. But at one time, Barbie was just a single doll in a plain old black and white bathing suit. Robin Gerber explores how Barbie came to be in her new book, Barbie and Ruth.
The actual idea for having an adult doll came from a woman named Ruth Handler. She had founded Mattel Toy Company in 1945, and in the early 50s, she observed her own daughter, Barbara, playing with adult paper dolls with her friends and realized that these little girls really did not have an adult three-dimensional doll to play with. They only had baby dolls, and so they could only pretend to be mothers. And Ruth understood that little girls just want to play at being big girls. And so she had this idea, but found that the men in her company, the male designers and researchers, thought it was a terrible idea. They insisted mothers would never buy their daughters a doll with breasts.
And what about the public? When Barbie eventually hit the market, was the buxomness an issue?
Yes, it was for mothers. But you know, Ruth had hired a man named Ernest Dichter, one of the first psychologists to come to companies and say, I can tell you how to sell stuff by appealing to emotions in people. She had had him do focus groups and talk to mothers and daughters, and they decided to market this doll as a teenage fashion model. And that way, mothers could feel reassured that the doll would teach their daughter good grooming, and the daughters could still have the doll to play with.
So it did sell. I mean, once it hit the market?
Not immediately when it hit the market, because she brought the doll out at Toy Fair, and like any product today, it was dependent on these buyers buying it and getting it into their stores. Well, they didn't think mothers would buy the doll, and so there were very few orders. But Ruth had a brilliant television commercial that some people listening, I'm sure, will remember, showing Barbie as a real girl.
Barbie, you're beautiful. You make me feel. My Barbie doll is really real.
That television commercial really moved the kids. And when they got out of school about 3 months after Toy Fair in June 1959, they started begging for that doll. And it actually took Mattel 3 years to catch up with demand.
How much were the kids, paying for Barbie when she first came out in 1959?
You know, she was $3 in 1959, and honestly, you can buy one today for $5. Because the real genius, of course, it's the razor blade theory that's going on with Barbie. You buy the doll, and then you have to get all those clothes and accessories. And
so what you're telling me is that my two-year-old daughter now, I'm just in for a lifetime of buying Barbie clothes and stuff?
Most likely, Kai.
I don't know whether to be heartened or heartwarmed by that. The book by Robin Gerber about the Barbie doll and the woman who created her is called Barbie and Ruth. Robin, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Tina Fleming back at Kipps Toyland points out that Barbie isn't just for little girls anymore.
You really would be amazed how many adults collect these dolls, men too.
If you're a fan, child or no, take a look at our website. We've got that old commercial that Robin Gerber was talking about. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, courtesy of the New York Post today, the latest example of how banks that have taken government money are trying really, really hard to look like they're not being frivolous. Last month, Citigroup canceled a weekend outing for top performers at its Smith Barney brokerage unit. Appearances are important, right? Right. So nobody got a free vacation. What they got instead was cash. We called Citi to confirm this. Top brokers got gift cards loaded with $3,000 on them. The rest got a grand or maybe two. Total cost was $3.5 million. Still, a Citi spokesman told us today the company's saving about 80% from earlier employee recognition programs. And that is Marketplace this Monday afternoon. We're distributed and produced by American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 79 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ dropped 25 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 closed down 6 points. We'll call that an even 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, innovations in electronic patient care.
I would guess nearly 500,000 patients with networked implanted devices now, and the newest generation uses cellular technology, so there's no connection, there's no use of the phone line.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.